By way of background, it's a paper based on a talk that I first gave in Oxford, actually, a couple of years ago. I've changed it quite a bit since then, partly as a result of those comments. And now I'm hoping to get this chapter published in a book I'm editing on process and action and experience. So Elizabeth Anscombe argued that a central feature of intentional action is that you know what you're doing without observation. Your knowledge of what you're doing doesn't come after your action, but is somehow constitutively bound up with it. The doing and the knowing involve either the same or closely related sensitivity. So acting intentionally turns out to be something like exercising your knowledge of what you're doing. She raises a number of problem cases for this principle, including painting a wall yellow. How can you know you're painting a wall yellow without looking to see what colour is emerging on the wall? And those following her have raised further problem cases. Notably, Davidson introduced the example of intentionally making 10 legible carbon copies without knowing that that's what you're doing. So this is Davidson. In writing heavily on this page, I may be intending to produce 10 legible carbon copies. I do not know or believe with any confidence that I'm succeeding, but if I am producing 10 legible carbon copies, I'm certainly doing it intentionally. Now, one kind of response to Davidson is to say that you do know what you're doing in this case, even if you do not know that you're succeeding. We can truthfully describe someone as crossing the road or making a cake, even if they're later interrupted and do not succeed in achieving either goal. The person making a cake knows that they're making a cake, even though they don't know that they will succeed. So Davidson's saying that you don't know that you're going to succeed may not be relevant to the question of whether you know what you're doing. Now, whether this diagnosis fits the carbon copy case depends on the degree to which success is taken to be implied by the idea of producing legible carbon copies. And there may be some ambiguity in our language here. It's essentially the question of whether it makes sense to say I'm unsuccessfully producing 10 carbon copies. So if you can say I'm producing 10 carbon copies, or sorry, maybe in the past I was producing 10 carbon copies unsuccessfully, then Davidson's argument gets no traction, because you could say the fact that you don't know whether or not you're going to succeed is irrelevant to whether you know or don't know that you're doing it. On the other hand, saying that I was unsuccessfully producing 10 carbon copies sounds a bit wrong. So it could be that it's actually the way we use this kind of phrase in the English language, that it does have success built into the notion of producing 10 carbon copies. I don't care which way you go on that. I've got an answer either way. If we take success not to be implied by the idea of producing 10 carbon copies, then that response, most recently in a book by Eric Marcus, he makes this argument nicely, that response works well. And Davidson doesn't have to have a counterexample to Anscombe. But if we think that producing 10 legible carbon copies is, say, trying to produce 10 legible copies and succeeding, then it's true that the agent doesn't know that they're doing this. The response I want to develop in this paper in support of Anscombe is that in this case it's a mistake to describe the agent as intentionally producing 10 legible carbon copies. So the response is to say, either we go, well, they did know that they were doing it, or if we understand the phrase differently, we're going to go, they weren't in fact doing it. And I'm going to defend that thought. Understood in this way, the action of producing 10 carbon copies is what I'm going to describe as a ballistic action. It's a two-stage action involving the agent doing one thing, which then results in the desired achievement without any further involvement, actual or potential, of the agent. It can be contrasted with a one-stage action where the agent is in some control of the production of the desired result throughout the process. I'm going to argue that ballistic actions are non-progressive achievements, by which I mean that they are things that are done, but at no moment, strictly speaking, is anyone actually doing them. Approaches to action that confine agency to the mind or the body treat all action where something is achieved outside the body as ballistic. The agent does their stuff and the rest is up to nature. And many of the classic examples in the philosophy of action, killing the king by pouring poison in his ear, or hitting a bullseye on a dartboard, are ballistic actions. I'm establishing that as a kind of metaphor for things which might involve throwing, but might involve something like throwing. If I'm right, then these all fall into the paradoxical sounding category of non-progressive achievements. The queen may have killed the king, but I suggest that, strictly speaking, at no moment was she killing him. I may have hit the bullseye, but I wasn't hitting it when I was merely throwing the dart, nor after I let go of the dart. They have two stages, and so aren't the most fundamental category of action. It makes sense to work out an account of one-stage actions before tackling the problems associated with two-stage actions. Moreover, if ballistic actions are non-progressive, there's a deeper sense in which they're not fundamental to the philosophy of action. That's that they're not things that an agent is ever really doing. I suggest that it makes philosophical sense to try to understand what it is to be doing something before working out what it is to have done something. Now, the distinction between the doing and the thing done is an instance of the more general distinction between process and achievement. In English, there's a familiar process-product ambiguity. We might say that the writing that was happening in the exam hall resulted in the writing that could be found later on in the exam papers. Obviously, the word writing is functioning differently in these two occurrences. First to refer to a process, and then to refer to the product of that process. Similarly, we may say that the warming up of the sea, the process, resulted in the warming up of the sea, the product. Where the latter means the same as the sea's having warmed up. Or the process of my crossing the road resulted in the achievement of my crossing the road. Using the phrase my crossing the road in these two different ways. So I think there is that ambiguity. I mean, it's often very easy to resolve it. And in these cases where I said the process of or the achievement of, that was a way of resolving it. But if we go back to the verb forms from which these ambiguous nominalizations derive, the language usually makes distinctions manifest in the aspects of the verbs. So there's a clear linguistic distinction between saying that I was crossing the road and saying that I crossed the road. The former uses the progressive, which is a species of the imperfective aspect, and the latter uses the perfective aspect. Nominalizing the former, the progressive, we might say that my crossing the road was happening, and nominalizing the latter, we might say that my crossing the road happened. This distinction of aspect isn't a distinction of tense. We can make the same distinction in the future tense between saying that I will be crossing the road and saying that I will cross the road. It's a distinction just between describing some occurrence as ongoing, whether in the past, the present, or the future, or describing it as a completed event. The distinction between ongoing processes and completed events applies to occurrences quite generally, and also more specifically to actions. There, we might distinguish between doing something, an ongoing process, and the thing done, the completed event, between a process of acting and the achievement. So you can see where I'm going, or actually I've been going this way for quite a long time in my research. I think that philosophers of action should have been talking about the processes. And that's partly why I like Aristotle, because I think he probably was talking about the processes, not the events, not the completed things. So he talked about them both. Describing what someone has done or will have done and describing what they are or will or were doing have different purposes. The former provides a list of achievements, like a CV. It's relevant for attributing praise and blame. The police need to know who did it, so that the court can then establish what someone has done and whether they should be punished. The fact that I flew to Brussels yesterday, for example, would have largely forensic interest. Describing what someone is or was or will be doing, however, is relevant in explaining, predicting, and planning behaviour. That I am flying to Brussels is relevant in determining that I should go to gate 256. And in explaining later on why I did go to gate 256. It's something that is present reality. It can be enjoyed or dreaded, perceived by others or interrupted by them. It's a very notable fact that the philosophy of action since Davidson has focused almost exclusively on achievements rather than processes. With Elizabeth Anscombe, however, that focus was much less clear. She seemed to be talking about the doings rather than the things done. And you probably know there's a kind of resurgence of interest in Anscombe, partly due to Michael Thompson's Life and Action book. He points out that almost all of Davidson's examples of action use the perfective aspect, whereas most of Anscombe's use the progressive aspect. In the work of Davidson, someone flipped a switch or buttered some toast, and Davidson takes the subject matter of the philosophy of action to be the completed events corresponding to these, the event of someone flipping a switch or buttering some toast. By contrast, Anscombe generally uses the present progressive when describing herself sitting in a chair writing, someone crossing the road, or someone moving their hand up and down while pumping water into a cistern. Now, as has often been remarked since Aristotle discussed this in the Metaphysics, it's possible to be doing or undergoing something without it ever being the case that one has done it or undergone it. Just because I'm crossing the road, it doesn't mean that I've crossed it, or indeed ever will have. If we only consider completed events in thinking about action, we won't have anything to consider with respect to crossing the road in this case, although we will be able to consider related actions like starting to cross the road or trying to cross the road. But what gets missed out is the action of crossing the road, the thing that you were doing. If you only focus on the completed events, that one becomes invisible. It's clear that there are processes of doing things with no corresponding achievements. The thing never gets done. But what I want to describe is the converse possibility. It's not strictly a converse. The possibility going the other way, that of things that have been done where at no moment was anyone doing them. It certainly sounds paradoxical to say that I did something without ever doing it, but I'm going to argue that it's perfectly reasonable to say this for the central examples of achievements as described in standard contemporary philosophy of action. Now, it's not particularly controversial that instantaneous things can happen without ever having been happening. For example, the new year started without ever having been starting. But what may seem less obvious is whether there are non-instantaneous happenings such that there was no moment when they were happening. The question is whether it's possible for it to be true both that O fied and that there was no moment when O was fying for a non-instantaneous fying. So Helen Stewart recently has argued not, and she describes the following as something like a metaphysical come semantical rule. If an event E happened by T, then E must have been happening at some time before T. Okay, so that's her rule. Now, if she's right, then it follows that there can be no non-instantaneous, non-progressive achievements, things which someone did but at no time was doing. If I did something over a period of time, then a non-instantaneous event of my doing it happened. It would follow from this rule that the event of my doing it was happening at some time. And I think it follows from this that there was some time when I was doing it. So I think if the event of my doing it was happening, then I think we can say I was doing it. And so my achievement would not be non-progressive. But I want to challenge this rule. It doesn't strike me as very firmly embedded in our linguistic practices and intuitions or derivable from anything that is. And actually, I'm going to suggest it's ungrammatical. Consider an example given by Peter Hallman. There is a machine in a transistor factory that checks transistors and rejects a certain proportion. Let us suppose that it rejects all transistors for the first third of the day and then rejects no transistors at all for the rest of the day. So presumably something's gone wrong in the factory. The machine rejected a third of the transistors, but at no point was the machine rejecting a third of the transistors. To begin with, it was rejecting all the transistors, then it was rejecting no transistors. So it's a really horrible example in terms of... But, you know, simple enough. So it did reject a third of the transistors, but it wasn't ever rejecting a third of the transistors. Now, I think, therefore, we can describe the machine's action of rejecting a third of the transistors as non-progressive. It sounds wrong to say that at some particular time towards the end of the day, when in fact it was rejecting no transistors at all, that it was rejecting a third of the transistors. And I suggest that the reason it sounds wrong is that the mechanism that was operating at this time was not a reject a third of the transistors mechanism, but a reject no transistors mechanism. When we talk of what was happening, we're talking of what sort of mechanism was operating. We're looking at the realizing of some underlying power or potentiality in the system and characterizing the process of this power being realized in terms of what the power is a power for. So this is why I'm at this seminar, because I've got something to say about power. So I propose the following principle for the semantics of a progressive phrase, like a process of achieving P was happening at time T. And it's the following. It's right to say that a process of achieving P is or was or will be happening at a time T when there is a mechanism or was or will be a mechanism operating at time T that is characterized by its resulting in something that is in fact P. So I think that the right way to describe processes is by reference to the underlying powers. It's essentially the principle. And you can spell that out in the way I suggested, or perhaps there might be an alternative way of doing it. Now, Stewart does consider a different possible counterexample provided by an anonymous referee and rejects it. It's the example of someone shooting a coyote that goes away and dies 24 hours later as a result of its injuries. So the person killed a coyote, but according to the objection, it's wrong to say that at any particular moment they were killing the coyote. They weren't killing it while it was slinking away to lick its wounds, because they weren't doing anything at that time. But it seems wrong to describe them as killing it while they were shooting it. All they were doing was shooting it. They were making a shot at killing it. They were trying to kill it, but not actually killing it. Now, the ambiguity that I described at the beginning applies here too. So somebody might say, yeah, they're killing. What are you doing to the person shooting the coyote? I'm killing a coyote. Perfectly reasonable thing to say. And you might say it's true whether or not the coyote dies. I might be interrupted. So I might describe what I was doing last week as killing a coyote, but I didn't succeed. Like I was making a cake, but there was a power cut. Or I was crossing a road but struck by a random atomic bomb or something. So we certainly have certain action phrases which allow this possibility. You might think that killing a coyote is one of them. It doesn't sound quite right to me, but it's, if so, then it doesn't stop the example working. Okay, Stewart's response to this example is to insist that either we should say that they were killing the coyote after they'd finished shooting it, or we should say they were killing it while they were shooting it. But this insistence seems quite forced to me and not well motivated by the intuitive power of that rule. And as I say, I want to suggest it's not grammatical once we start taking into account the process product ambiguity. In this rule as expressed, the very thing that happened is also said to have been happening. Something E happened. And then the same thing is described as having been happening. So the same thing is described using the progressive and the perfective aspects. But if we tease that out, the product process ambiguity, we might want to say, look, the event E is the product of a process. If an event E, let's say the product of process P, happened by T, then E must have been happening at some time prior to T. But obviously what was happening at some time prior to T wasn't E, but it was P. So the rule embeds a kind of mistake by not taking into account that there is this distinction between the process and the product. It's the process that was happening. It was the thing that resulted in the event. And it's the event that happened. But once you put this into place in the rule, it stops having the force that it had against these non-progressive achievements. Take the killing of the coyote example again. We can deny that my achievement of killing the coyote is the result of a process of my killing the coyote. We can say instead that it's the result of a different process, the process of my shooting it. So in this case, E is a product of a process not described in the same terms. The killing of the coyote, the event E, is a product of a process P, which is a shooting of a coyote. And of course, the shooting of the coyote did indeed happen at an earlier time. We don't have to say that the killing of the coyote was the result of a process of killing the coyote. That's not forced on us. And these ballistic action examples are going to be examples in which that simply isn't the case, where you've got a product which is described as X was happening, or X happened, and it's a result of an event, a result of a process, which isn't described in terms of X, but in terms of something else. And this is why this principle of hers shouldn't be applied, and in this case, doesn't apply. I'm defining a ballistic action as an intentional action where the agent is in control of initiating a process which results and is intended to result in the goal of the action, but where the agent has no intention of being involved, actually or potentially, in the action beyond setting up this process. Their agency is going to be completely withdrawn from the process. So you can see the point, why we're going to have a problem with this, because a ballistic action involves two processes, the one that the agent's actually actively engaged in, and the one that's following from it, the one where nature's doing its work. This is by contrast with a non-ballistic action where the agent's involved throughout the process that results in the goal, with some perhaps minimal level of control until the goal is achieved. So in the first stage of a ballistic action, the agent is exercising their agency. They're in control of the results of this agency, and in the second stage, they have no further role. If the result of their agency in the first stage, the process they've actively initiated that now takes over to produce the final intended outcome. Yeah, so I suppose I misdescribed it. If the event here is the killing of the coyote, then what happened before wasn't just her shooting the coyote, but also the coyote dying of its wounds. So you've essentially got two processes in place that were happening before T, neither of which is best described as her killing the coyote. Okay, so another example, it's still involving killing. Suppose a gardener killed some slugs yesterday. She did it on purpose by spreading pellets around a vegetable patch. There was a time when she was spreading the pellets, but was there a time when she was killing the slugs? In the afternoon, she was intending to kill them and trying to kill them, and not yet actually killing them. But then she wasn't killing them later because she was on a plane to Rio de Janeiro. By the time the slugs were eating the poison and dying in the middle of the night, she'd withdrawn her agency from the process. So it seems that there was no time when she was actually killing them, even though she certainly killed them. Now, going back to the earlier move, one might avoid the appearance of paradox here by insisting that she was killing the slugs, just when she was spreading pellets with the intention of killing them. If someone had asked her what she was doing, she might have replied, "I'm killing slugs. Those blighters will regret the day they ever started in on my cabbages." But this is tricky. Her interlocutor might reasonably, though pedantically, reply that she's exaggerating, and that, strictly speaking, she's not actually killing them there and then. She's just spreading poison in the hope that she will kill them. And English usage seems to allow us to go either way here, a pedantic way or the more freewheeling way. What I'm trying to do is to make sense of the pedantic way. I'm not arguing that we have to talk that way, but the fact that that way is available to us is what I'm going to make use of. Okay, it's... ballistic action is representative of a very familiar type described in the philosophy of action. A footballer might see their opportunity from the halfway line when the goalkeeper is off their line and fire off a hopeful shot, the ball ending up in the net. Their involvement ends after they've kicked the ball, but they're still responsible for the goal after the ball goes in the net. They've scored a goal. But the most familiar examples in the literature, so sport provides some good examples, but the most familiar ones are killing. Killing someone by pouring poison in the ear, pumping up and down on the handle, firing a single shot, pressing a button, and so on. Indeed, murder by means of ballistic action is so common in the philosophical literature that one might almost take it to typify intentional action. But in fact, it's a rather unusual sort of behaviour. When you write a paper, you're writing it until it's done. You don't make a stab at it and wait for nature to take its course. The same goes for taking a walk, eating breakfast, making a cup of coffee, driving to the airport, putting on your clothes, smoking a cigarette, telling someone something, and so on. Even murders are usually controlled actions and not ballistic actions. You can kill someone by beating them to death or firing bullets at them until they're dead, say with a machine gun. So Lee Harvey Oswald, who is the philosopher's favourite murderer, didn't just take a shot at Kennedy, he kept shooting until he saw that the job was done. As Michael Thompson writes, checking to see if the victim is done for and repeating as necessary. So Thompson's very good on this. I'm just going to read his quote about Davidson's carbon copy example. This is Davidson's example, which I read out earlier, of someone trying to make 10 legible carbon copies by writing on the top copy, hoping the impression will go all the way through. But the more ordinary case is like this. You write on the top sheet, trying to make a good impression to get through all the carbon, then look to see if your impression made it through to all of them. If it did, you stop. If it didn't, you remove the last properly impressed sheet and begin again. If necessary, you repeat. Even the man who has to go through five stages is all along, from the first feeble impression, making 10 copies of this document. He knows it all along. The one who doesn't know it, Davidson's man, must be under some strange mafia threat. He gets one chance, no checking, and he's dead if he doesn't manage it. Well, for him, the making of the inscription is like the buying of a lottery ticket. You can say he made 10 copies intentionally if you like, but it will not be an illustration of the topic of Anscombe's book, any more than lottery winning is when you bought the ticket with that aim. So I like his analysis, except at the end when he says, you can say he made 10 copies if you like. Well, he did make 10 copies. I mean, that would be the right thing to say. I want to say what's less clear is that he was ever making 10 copies intentionally. And I'll say a bit more to explain that. So whether the action is still under some control of the agent doesn't depend on whether they're actually intervening at the times, as his example illustrates. What matters is potential intervention. After the last bullet is fired, the agent may still have some control over the process, standing by, watching to see if there's need for further intervention, ready to shoot again if necessary. The point is that a non-ballistic action is a process realizing an agent's power to achieve what should be achieved for the eventual achievement of the intended goal. This process is not finished by a single unsuccessful attempt. It continues happening and resulting in achievements that should be achieved for the achievement of the goal until the goal is achieved, or until something stops the process. Now, the level of involvement that an agent must intend to retain in a non-ballistic action can be quite minimal. Standing by vaguely in case something else needs to be done may be sufficient. Suppose I'd asked the gardener, after she'd spread the pellets, to come away with me to Rio, and she says she can't because she's killing slugs. I might challenge this and say that she's done everything she can do. But if she says that she needs to be there to make sure it works, perhaps to respond in case they get washed away in a freak flood or something, that's enough to mean that her achievement of killing the slugs isn't a ballistic action. As Thompson says, to make the case for an ordinary action being a ballistic action, you usually have to include some strange conditions, like being under mafia threat not to intervene in the later stages if necessary. Well, that's why I put her on a plane to Rio. She just isn't part of the process anymore. The distinction between ballistic action and non-ballistic action may be characterized in terms of a distinction between two styles of practical rationality. In the first one, you go from G is to be achieved, and F is the way to achieve G, to F is to be achieved. And in the second one, you go from G is to be achieved, and F is a good shot at getting G achieved, to F is to be achieved. And sensitivity to either style of practical rationality means that the agent is acting with a certain goal. There's nothing wrong with the second style of practical rationality, and one can be sensitive to it and achieve F as a result, in which case one acted intentionally to achieve F. But in the case of non-ballistic action, the action that's sensitive to the second style of practical rationality, non-ballistic action, the first style, the agent is doing that series of things that results in the goal being achieved. Whereas in the case of ballistic action, the agent is doing something that's a good shot at achieving that goal. Now, that series of things that results in a goal being achieved involves acting, checking, acting again, and so on. Something that is a good shot at achieving a goal is just one thing. If I'm exercising my power to do something that's a good shot at achieving the goal, then when I've achieved that intermediate goal, the process is over. But if I'm exercising my power to do that series of things that results in the final goal being achieved, I must be capable of going on until the goal is achieved. Now consider the slug poisoner as poisoning again. At no moment during either stage of the killing is the gardener killing the slugs, I argue. At first she's doing something less, namely making a good shot at killing the slugs, or trying to kill slugs. Then afterwards she's doing nothing about it at all. And as I say, it's true that when asked what she's doing when spreading the pellets, she might say that she's killing the slugs. But this sounds more like bravado than the literal truth. Now, it would be different if she weren't about to board a plane to Rio, even if she were just going to bed. In that scenario, she could be sleeping peacefully, but still be in the process of killing the slugs, and have been in that process earlier too. The argument may seem to depend at this stage on the fact that it sounds wrong to say this or that about the killing of the slugs. Someone might respond that these things sound wrong for pragmatic reasons to do with conversational conventions, perhaps, and that it doesn't follow that these things are wrong. And maybe it doesn't sound that wrong anyway. Is this just rather a trivial, purely semantic question of how best to define what it is to be killing something? To respond to this worry, I need to fill in the story with a metaphysical account of processes that explains and justifies the intuitions I'm appealing to. So recall that in supporting Hallman's interpretation of his transistor checking example, I appeal to a principle connecting English usage to metaphysics in the following way. It's right to say that a process of achieving P is happening at time T when there is a mechanism operating at T that is characterized by its resulting in something that is in fact P. When it comes to describing the intentional behavior of agents, this talk of mechanism may be out of place. I don't mind thinking of people as mechanisms, but we don't need to. The principle can be transposed to one that is more appropriate for agency, as follows. It is right to say that an agent is achieving G at time T when at T they're exercising a power characterized by its resulting in something being achieved that is in fact G. Let us say that the gardener is killing the slugs if and only if she is achieving the death of the slugs. Then it follows that if she is killing the slugs at a certain time, she must be exercising a power at that time characterized by achieving that result under some description. Now, my claim in the previous section is that the gardener's power being exercised at that time is characterized as the power to make a good shot at achieving the death of the slugs. This falls short of being the power to achieve the death of the slugs. Something that is a good shot at achieving the death of the slugs is not the same thing as the death of the slugs. And the power to achieve one is not the power to achieve the other under a different description. The power to kill some slugs is different from the power to make a really good shot at it. The power to kill slugs is realized when a gardener has the opportunity to make repeated efforts, the capacity to check on the success of these efforts, the disposition to keep going until the slugs are dead and nothing's getting in the way. And this power is being realized, even if it turns out the gardener only needs to shake their can once. If she's about to catch the flight to Rio, then only the power to make a good shot at killing the slugs can be realized. And this is at the heart of the distinction between ballistic and controlled action. If we accept the principle above about what we can describe an agent as achieving, then we get the desired conclusion that ballistic actions are non-progressive achievements. Okay, so back to Anscombe. As already remarked, Anscombe tends, though not exclusively, to use the progressive present when giving examples of actions. A man is pumping, and so on. And as Thompson has argued, this makes room for the idea of practical self-knowledge being somehow internal to the action rather than following on from it. So this is a sort of wonderful Anscombe idea that the knowledge, instead of being a response to the thing you know, is somehow constitutive of the thing you know. Although Anscombe is also interested in applying the idea of non-observational practical self-knowledge to knowing what you're going to do and knowing what you've done, various other things in fact, the central case is knowing what you are in the process of doing, knowing what you're doing while doing it. There's a difference between knowing you're baking a cake and knowing you have baked a cake. You don't have to wait until the cake is baked before you know you're baking it. That you would need to wait to know you have baked it. If you never finish baking it, you are still in the process of baking it. So we shouldn't be puzzled by Anscombe's claim that you know you're painting a wall yellow without observation. Painting a wall yellow is a controlled action, and observation is an integral part of it. You have to check how it's coming out and adapt your behavior accordingly. If after a few brush strokes the wall is looking decidedly green, you head off to the paint shop for a different can. This is all part of the process of painting it yellow. That you know you're painting the wall yellow without observation doesn't mean that there's no observation needed to paint the wall yellow. Observing that you're doing it right is involved in painting the wall yellow. What it does mean is that there's no further observation required to know that's what you're doing. If you are painting the wall yellow, then you don't have to observe yourself doing it in order to know that you are. So I may not have made that completely clear, but clearly observation figures, but not, if you like, of what one is doing, but in what one is doing. So one can't be painting the wall yellow without observation. And therefore, one can't, strictly speaking, know that one is painting the wall yellow without observation. But the observation is not figuring in how one knows it, but figuring in how one does it. So Anscombe can quite rightly say, it's knowing what you're doing is knowledge without observation, even if what you're doing requires observation. Okay. There's no need to limit the claim that you know what you're doing without observation to those things you're merely trying to do or intending. That's the move some people have made that Anscombe resists. It's not merely that I'm intending to paint the wall yellow, that I know I'm painting it yellow. And I know that without observation. So I'm knowing something about what's happening out there in the room. It would be bizarre to claim that you can know what's happening out there in the room without using observation of some sort. But the place for that observation is as part of the painting the wall yellow, and is not as part of some further process leading to knowing that's what you're doing. Observation is part of the doing, and as such part of the knowing what you're doing, but not an extra part. So understood this way, the case is unproblematic, I think. But that's because painting the wall yellow is a controlled action. So what about another of Anscombe's examples, writing something with your eyes shut? So suppose I write, conflating this with another of the examples, that I am a fool on a piece of paper with my eyes shut. Or on a piece of paper. In her example, it was on a blackboard. Here there is a lack of control over some aspects of the action. For example, if there's no ink coming out, I make no adaption. It's a ballistic action in my terms. I am tracing the pattern for I am a fool on some paper with the end of my pen with the intention of making corresponding marks. But the process of the pen making the marks corresponding to the path traced out is a secondary process not controlled by me at all. I initiate that process by pressing the pen to the paper, and I give it its inputs by tracing the right pattern, but that is the extent of my involvement. Now, it's a slightly more interesting example than the ones I was looking at earlier, because the process of my setting up the second process and that second process are happening at the same time. So I'm tracing the pattern at the same time as the ink is forming on the blackboard, or on the bit of paper, whatever it is. So it's not as if I could take a flight to Rio and the thing continue to happen without me. But it doesn't, by my definition of a ballistic action, it still counts as a ballistic action. I'm initiating a process in a controlled way, and then nature is taking its course without me having any involvement in that second process. Of course, in real life, I would have involvement in that second process. I'd glance at it. But we have to think of a kind of Michael Thompson example where someone's got a gun to my head. If you look, you're dead, sort of thing. So I can't check, I can't adapt. Okay, given what I've been arguing about ballistic actions being non-progressive achievements, my writing, I am a fool with my eyes shut, is not something I'm ever actually in the process of doing. Strictly speaking, I'm only ever in the process of doing lesser things, like tracing a pattern with my pen. If that's right, we're licensed to ignore this case in assessing Anscombe's principle of practical self-knowledge. And the same goes for Davidson's example of the carbon paper copies. While Thompson is right to say that the example as described is very weird and requires something like a mafia threat, it does represent a genuine possibility. And the response I'm recommending is to say that supposing there is this mafia threat, then the agent is not, strictly speaking, in the process of making 10 carbon copies. And to reiterate, this doesn't depend on the norms of the English language, which are perhaps not very clear here in any case, but on the underlying metaphysical fact that she, the agent, is not exercising a power of making 10 carbon copies, but in this case, only exercising a power of making a good attempt at making 10 carbon copies.